Bringing them up was easier said than done. It took nearly an hour to remove the bodies and to store them safely. There was a freezer room, and Palamedes reluctantly allowed them to be interred there, and to get the houses up and crowded into the dining hall. Harrowhark's skeletons could climb a ladder, even bearing wrapped corpses, but Column the Eighth did not respond to pleas, threats, or physical stimulus. He was slightly less gray than previous, but he had to be hauled up bodily by Corona and Gideon. The moment he saw Column, Teacher cried out in horror. Getting him up had been the hardest part. He now rested at the end of the table with a bowl of unidentifiable herbs burning under his chin, the smoke curling around his face and eyelashes. Currently, everyone not stretched out on the floor of the dining room, lying in state in the freezer room, or huffing herbs, was sitting around miserably clutching cups of tea. It was weirdly like their first day in Kanan House, in both suspicion and dullness, just with a bigger body count. You're listening to Nunpod with Left Grief, episode 18. I'm sorry. I'm really sorry.
Love how you delivered the last line of that excerpt.
I really love how you delivered the last line of that excerpt. It hurt.
That gave me a gift.
And it's hurting people's feelings.
I think this is the first place where I see Mir almost kind of recognizing her own writing style, because like it is that reflection duality happening. This reconvening in this space. This is the third time they've grouped together in this space in this way. Teacher was a guest at the anniversary party, but Teacher is more central to the ring ceremony and this one. Mm-hmm. So technically it's three, but I feel like the first and the third are more related than the anniversary party.
Yeah, and the anniversary party felt like an exception. It was really trying a different way of relating to each other. And now that Magnus and Abigail are gone, that experimental mode is gone too.
Similarly to how chapter 17 had a very interesting kind of foggy time dilation-y variation, there's also a really good disorientation. Like things are familiar, but they're unfamiliar kind of energy to the writing in this chapter that I think is just really also super appropriate for Gideon's experience right now.
She's so tired.
She's like, this is familiar, but also everything is weird and nothing really feels like it makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like there were so many questions that got set up in chapter 17 that get answered in 18, which is so rare in this series, particularly to get an answer immediately.
There's stuff that we explicitly talked about. You know, we were theorizing like who told Teacher, and we concluded, well, it's probably the second.
Yeah, like, what was the second up to? And it's like, yeah, they were going for Teacher.
Yeah. I think one of the things that emphasizes Gideon's fatigue is, like, this is the first time, like, where Gideon's kind of, it's almost like seeing double. Like, Gideon's, like, talked about them as a unit, but now it's like, okay, how do I tell them apart? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you can kind of, like, feel Gideon being like, which one's which one? Okay, that one's got a sword. Okay.
Mm-hmm. We talked about in the last episode this ambiguity of rank, and that ends up being the central tension of certainly the beginning of this chapter, where, yeah, that ambiguity is in-world ambiguity, because Judith is like, I outrank everybody here, and the third is like, no, the fuck you do not, and she's like, I actually do, though.
And then they're also like, well, it's contextual, and so then we learn that the dynamics between these different ranks depend on the situation. Which is interesting information going into taking into Nona.
And that is true, I will say, looking at sort of the British system. Generally speaking, the nobility outranks military ranks, except in a wartime military context, then it doesn't.
Yeah. So because the lictors have a degree of relationship to the military, but not... in the same way that like the second or the fourth would. There is a degree of ambiguity whether this is a military training test. Like, you could make an argument that it is. You could also make an argument that this is more about elevated ranks. That might
I mean, this is a theocratic empire.
Yeah.
So the distance between the church and the military was...
So the fact that, you know, both the third and the second are seeing themselves as central to the hierarchy in this particular context makes sense, because they're going to obviously prefer their own perspective on it. I think also interestingly, like if one were to ask Teacher or John, I think the ninth would actually come in as a strong contender for who has authority in this situation, even though Harrow and Gideon have no fucking clue how the ninth operates within this theocratic society. Like, protecting the society from hungry ghosts is kind of what the ninth does.
Kind of. I don't know, though, because they have one that they do.
They have one.
Do they do everybody's?
They don't do everyone's, but Teacher understands that what is down there is not alive and very hungry and very desperate and very angry. And
Teacher also doesn't suggest, though, like, actually, you guys should be listening to Harrowhark. Like, he might
no,
have, but he
doesn't. But I think if Harrowhark understood the responsibilities that the Ninth were set up to fulfill within the theocratic society, she would advocate. Maybe she wouldn't, because it would be kind of giving away secrets in a way that she really likes to keep to herself. But I think as the Empire's experts in protection from ravenous ghosts, there is an argument to be made there.
I don't think that they are set up to be experts, though, because John set the locks on everything.
Fair enough. They're just kind of custodians of the space where the locks are.
I think that's it.
Okay. Their knowledge isn't actually about the locks itself.
It's not clear, though, whether they're doing something to maintain. But I think that they're not, because if they were doing something to maintain the tomb, then when Harrow said that she had gotten in, John would have gone, oh, shit.
Oh,
they haven't been doing the thing.
This possibly presents an answer to another one of our questions, which is how does the vault, another of our questions at in our chapter 17 episode, which is how is the vault maintained?
If John made it.
John made it, and John can stop time.
Yeah, okay.
John can stop the degradation of these wards because John can stop time.
Sure, okay. Yeah, I think that works.
It's the simplest one I have come across yet.
Well, and I think the fact that he made the wards on Electo's tomb and those don't degrade, like, surely Electo is more powerful than the Hungry Ghosts, I assume?
Yeah.
I guess we don't really know.
Well, I think we know in the sense of how much effort John has put into the guardians and custodianship of these spaces. John made an entire house, an entire planet around keeping Electo locked up. And like, he left some constructs alone on an empty planet to keep.
Yeah.
Him
going. Yeah.
That is,
I buy that.
That to me says very different levels of risk that he is trying to manage.
Although some of that risk might not be power related, because John has the specific tie to Electo.
Yes. True.
So she's risky because of that tie.
Yeah.
Going back to Judith's claim to authority in this situation is because war powers. And I want to touch on the imperial use of interpreting something as war that is as small as killing two people.
Yeah.
Because certainly that's not a thing that's unusual for an imperial power to do.
It's great.
Some deaths are cheaper than others. And Marta is saying the killing of a scion and their cavalier is an act of war. We are at war now. She doesn't even have a sense of who she's at war with, but she's like, this is now war and we're doing war rules. And that tells us something about the logic of empire.
Yes.
Because because it doesn't make sense on its face.
Yeah.
Like, a murder makes more sense.
Yeah, but a threat to the power structure is engagement.
And obviously some element of that is that's the rule that makes it possible for Judith to be in charge, and Judith feels more comfortable if she is in charge, and so she's doing the rule. But like, that's also how it works in real life.
Yeah, yeah. And similarly to how it's worked in real life, and for me, my brain is mostly pulling at World War One history here. Mm-hmm. We have a larger context of escalation of a crisis. Like in Dominicus in general, and the system and the empire, we see a degradation of power systems. We're losing lictors. There have all these imperial fronts that are needing a constant supply of child soldiers. And the lictors themselves are begging the god emperor to reinforce this with more power. This is not a stable state. Mm-hmm. And so these people have come together as representatives of this larger empire. And that is the context of this death. Like, it's not just two people got murdered. It's two people who represent the attempts of the empire to shore up its strength and control over the situation. That's what's getting murdered too.
Mm-hmm.
Like the emperor's efforts to shore up his power, the emperor's efforts to retain control over the houses, those are the things that are being threatened by this death, by these deaths. So like, you know, a guy got shot, and technically that started World War One, but there was a large amount of political context that I actually can't even remember, but I remember like—
Anarchists did it.
So anarchists and communists often are the problem, air quotes, which we will come to talk about in Nona. Love you, hot sauce. But
I want hot sauce to have a good day.
I want hot sauce to have a good day too. I want to just like take her to the aquarium and like get her all the hot dogs and popcorn and donuts she wants.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hot sauce should have a great day.
That poor kid.
Yeah. So in terms of like retaining control, you know, they have to have some sort of tipping point in which they can escalate and activate these wartime rules.
Yeah, I think that the place that I go to is Palestine and how small an act of resistance can count as a military threat.
Yes.
For Israeli logic.
Yeah, the one that jumps to mind is like a girl who threw a rock at a tank and then like a teenager and then was imprisoned.
That's happened a bunch of times.
Bunch of times.
And in this scenario, Judith is a person who tortures people to death by doing the thing that Silas does to them.
As a job.
That's her job. And she's doing great at it, and her career is going well.
Yeah, and we haven't talked about this for a while, but like, you know, Gideon thinks about freedom from the indentured servitude of the ninth and thinks about being empowered, but like these are all people who are active participants in this like theocratic, deep metaphysical violence.
Mm-hmm.
And like, we're literally, there's someone in the room right now who has had his soul siphoned to try and address the threat to their power structure. And like, there's this back tone the whole way through this chapter of like, where the fuck is Column? We just have an empty shell of a body that we desperately had to run up the ladder so it didn't become a further threat because of the hungry ghosts. And like, the very end of this chapter is Silas being like, giving him shit. But it's this weird backdrop that kind of, I think, keeps us from forgetting what is considered normal in this room.
Yeah, and there's so much in this chapter about what the rules are and what is normal. Like, teacher insists that this can't be a murder because murders are only done by the living. And what an interesting rule. Like, in a world where dead people have so much agency, why is it not murder if dead people do it?
Can you expand on do you mean like lictors having agency? Because there's a lot of like dead people not having agency in the sense that like what happens to your body and your soul after you're dead is not actually up to you as an individual.
Wake seems to have some agency after her death.
Okay.
Glorica seems to have some agency after her death. it seems that it is possible for dead people to have agency. And it is explicitly possible for dead people to do murders or to kill people. So why isn't it, like, is it murder? Yeah. Is it not murder because you can't put a ghost on trial? Like, why isn't it
murder? Yeah, is
it seems like ghosts are being treated as sort of a natural phenomenon rather than as people, but it seems like they're definitely people, right?
Yeah, they operate with motivation, they operate with context, they operate with temperament.
I can't believe I didn't say Palamedes. Holy shit, Palamedes has so much agency after his death.
Palamedes has the most and very important amounts of agency after his death.
Sorry, please get to... And Abigail.
And Abigail. our beloveds. And like when we talk about preventing violence, we are talking about changing the living conditions of people because they are responding to their conditions that might drive them to the desperation of certain kinds of violence, including murder. And the idea that like that approach is somehow irrelevant, that we're not interacting with, you know, their temperament, their conditions, the consequences of their actions, and that somehow like there's no process or perspective or even like dialogue about that is weird and conspicuous, because like there's both like creative agency within like the bubbles, there's physical agency on the real world, and there's ways in which like the ghosts can move back into the real world in permanent ways. And these aren't things that there's ignorance about. These are things that are just considered kind of normal, but to only have a like a judicial framework for living people on living people is a weird anomaly.
Yeah.
If teacher murdered someone, like, would it be considered a murder?
Is teacher telling us that he's allowed to kill everyone?
Yeah. Could teacher just be like, free reign for me, buddies.
I'm just like a tornado, my guy.
I do think though, as a little teacher fangirl over here, I think his intent is to clarify their perspective versus what they should be considering as a problem here. Because I think he's trying to open up what they're looking at and examining. Like murder is a very often socially motivated thing. And if it's done by a hungry ghost, maybe it's not so socially motivated, but by metaphysical motivations.
I want to suggest that is political misinformation, because when we see ghosts acting murderously, their motivations are aligned with what we seem to know of their living self.
Sure, even as a collective post-resurrection, that does kind of remain true. Like resurrection beasts as collectives of death is in alignment with what those things would have wanted in life. I can see that.
Well, and I'm thinking of like, okay, so we see Wake tries to kill everyone, which doesn't, we don't immediately, there's sort of some ambiguity, like, is Wake just a weird murder lady? Or
a little.
Is it that she got real angry as a ghost and that's part of what becoming a ghost was like for her? But everybody else in the river bubble also got murdered, basically. And so like, why aren't they all rage monsters? And then we see Matthias is like, I'm gonna go fight a monster. And that is fully aligned with his personality. He's not just a rage monster. He's gonna go do a specific killing for a noble purpose. So it seems like when ghosts wanna kill stuff, it's the same kind of stuff that they would wanna kill in life.
Yeah. Yeah. When we get to talking about resurrection beasts in a bit more detail with a bit more like source material, I would love to revisit this particular piece of it, knowing that like they are made of what was life and life that wanted to continue living. And the idea of like, so Matthias Nonius killing a monster for noble reasons, like there are reasons to kill that might be vengeful. There are reasons to kill that might be preventative of future death and harm. And And so, like, individuals have different motivations, even as ghosts, for doing a violence.
And also, like, the kind of intervention, the kind of repair that the ghosts seek out seems to be shaped by their personality. Mm-hmm. Glorica didn't try to murder everyone. Glorica went home and went, "Do you fucking know about these assholes?" And that feels right.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Although I would love to read the fanfic where the Glorica ghost was like, "I'm going to go personally murder the Lord and Lady of Excuse Me."
Please write that for us. If you want to write that, I will personally commission it from you so Han can have their dreams come true.
Thank you.
Please contact us should you wish to commission. I think it's interesting that, like, this debate around authority that they're having is very devoid of acknowledging this larger context of the theocratic implications of the power structures and how power is used over living people. Like,
yeah,
like, the navigation of life and death is where power comes from to impose itself on living people within this theocratic system. And all of these people who have access to that power and benefit from that power just, like, are not engaging with that as a piece of the puzzle in any way whatsoever. Is that something that they were raised to be ignorant of, raised to be avoidant of engaging with, or something that there is a distinct separation of how they talk about it versus how they talk about the dead?
It seems like this is an environment with very little space for a critical tradition. Yeah. And that's the kind of thing that you don't notice unless somebody points it out to you.
Yeah.
Or unless you have an encounter with an alternative.
I feel like Abigail and Palamides having any time for extended conversations would start making room for that in a way that would absolutely be a threat for Kithareia.
I really wish that Kithareia had made a different set of gambles and had some serious conversations with Abigail, because I think Abigail would have been a big fucking ally to the cause. I think Abigail would have been a damn good rebel.
Yeah. Yeah. Dear Tanzimir, can you just rewrite the whole book with, like, a couple of changes that lead to extremely consequential effects down the line?
I think that this would have been a really different, interesting story.
Yeah.
It would not have given us the grand tragedy.
Yeah. And this, and the grand tragedy and the like, no one gets to be happy is a very specific theme and tone within this series that, like, you know, Abigail living would have changed it.
I think the thing, second commission of the day, what if Kithareia had been an optimist? What if Kithareia had been a utopian and had the plan, "I'm going to come fuck up this plan," but instead of trying to fuck it up by killing everyone, had tried to fuck it up by undermining it ideologically.
Also, yeah. Also, yeah, please, we would like to read it. Okay, and I'm going to explicitly say this. If we make a bid for art and we say that we will pay someone to make it, one, we are completely fucking serious.
Yeah, we're super serious.
Super serious. And two, we want to feature it and talk about it here on the podcast. So if that like turns your brain on and you have ideas, I seriously fucking mean it. Get in touch. These alternate pathways allow us to explore this universe more, because totally, we're still exploring it within the context of the world that Tanzimir built. And knowing, like, thinking about a resistance that had a lictor as a core part of its leadership or a core part of its, like, influences would be a really fascinating, like a defecting lictor. Sign me up for that narrative. Like, yes, they kind of all defected in their own way, but, like, one that specifically was like, "Hey, Blood of Eden, you want to, you know, collaborate a little bit?" Knowing that their own power comes from this toxic power system and that there would have to be a reconciliation, even if they achieved the goals of Blood of Eden, of the fact that they were retaining that power, eventually, like, you would have to face the question of, like, do you destroy yourself in alignment with the goals of that resistance?
What the fuck does a literal truth and reconciliation trial look like?
So I've talked about the Poppy Wars before on this podcast. The Poppy Wars, as in all books that I've read that reconcile, you know, exploitation of the individual, exploitation of the metaphysical and supernatural in service of an empire and the impact of that on the individual, it has the most satisfying ending in its trilogy for answering that question that I've found so far in terms of, yeah, that makes sense. Because it's a hard question to ask and it's a hard question to read the answer to.
Yeah.
If you want to have a read one answer to that question, that trilogy will take you down that path. Again, with mentioning Poppy Wars, it's a hard read. Go and read the trigger warnings before you dig into that one.
Yeah. So in addition to fighting the third over whether the second or the third outranks, Judith also thinks that she outranks Teacher. And Teacher is not interested in fighting with her about this because she is simply wrong.
And it's really fascinating, too, because Teacher, like, sees himself, he's a representative of the Emperor. And while they are heads of the houses, he outranks them. Once they're lictors, they outrank him. Mm-hmm. But right now, they are temporarily mortals, and he is immortal, and he speaks for the Emperor, and they don't. So, suck it, Judith.
There's this question of, does the highest in the House of the Third outrank the highest of the House of the Second? And he's like, sweetie pie, the highest of the rank of the Second does not approach the lowest of the House of the First.
Like, he literally just called you all children. He genuinely meant it, not in a derogatory way, but in a way
just emotionally.
Yeah, like, he means that in a guardianship-type sense, because the House of the First and his sense of himself as a part of the House of the First is guardianship over the children of the First, which is the rest of the houses.
I think that Teacher indicates a really interesting theory of violence when he asks what possible motive could lead to killing Magnus and Abigail. Who would want to harm them? A good man and a good woman. Which tells this underlying story of bad things happen to bad people.
Yep. And again, reinforces that, like, none of the people in this room think that the ways that they access power here are bad or worthy of criticism.
They're paragons. What could anyone possibly object to? I imagine that it was really difficult for Kithariya to mind her face in that paragraph.
Trying to play this as, like, someone who is so uninvolved, like, the Seventh is not part of this power struggle.
Mm-hmm.
But Kithariya is. Kithariya is the one who ranks above all of them in the room.
And is so used to being treated with immediate, obvious, complete deference. For 10,000 years. I know you have had the experience of playing dress up where you have imaginary social rank. And I know that even doing that for 3 days in a row, it becomes a little weird to go back into the rest of the world.
And I remember having an experience where I had stepped out of that context for many, many years and stepped back into it for just a few hours. And it was so weird, like, and deference by people who did not know me, but simply saw me, saw how I held myself, and decided that I outranked them. Like, in a way in which I did not ask for or even want.
Yeah.
So it's, but it's also funny because I work with people who have not yet been, or are in the very early stages of learning what our society imposes in terms of, like, rank and deference. Like, toddlers do not give a shit about your decision-making and your authority in decision-making. They really don't care. And I think sometimes the ways that adults get frustrated with small children is because they're being denied what the authority that they're used to being given without question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the amount of resistance that a toddler gives to an adult would be really, really hostile from another adult.
Yeah, and the ways in which I see that be adult to adult, like that jumps to mind is like there was this, I think she was French, but this young woman, she was black, and she was like lighting a cigarette as she was like facing a bunch of riot officers who were trying to egg her on, and she's just like dismissing them, disregarding them, and there's this energy of like your authority means nothing to me. And the kind of like weird vibe building up, the energy building up in these riot officers is palpable. And you can see her peers being like, okay, we have a strategy for how we make sure we keep her safe, because we know the consequences of openly disregarding the ranking that they're commanding, they're demanding that we recognize. But when you see it, and it's almost always femme type people that I see doing this. It's like old ladies with handbags smashing police officers. Like it's women being like, go fuck yourself. And queer folk being like, go fuck yourself in a way that you can see the disturbance in the person who is normally used to being allowed to be violent.
I want to bring us back to the chapter almost. I'm aware that we have strayed, but I just want to make one really quick book recommendation while we're over here.
Yeah.
Folklore Fights the Nazis is a history of uses of humor in the, I believe it's Norwegian resistance to the Nazi occupation. And it was a whole lot of that. It was a whole lot of young women and old women. And they had different ways of absolutely fucking humiliating Nazi soldiers every time they saw them in public. And the thing that the old women would do was trip them up on fake social rules and act completely outraged that the Nazi had failed to show them some sort of appropriate deference to old women, that they were just making, it was just bullshit. They were making it up as an excuse to yell at this soldier in public. And the thing that the young women would do was actively walk up to the Nazi soldiers on the train and ask them if they needed help finding their mommy.
Les, my favorite that I've experienced is basically like a patronizing Ms. Frizzle energy where the cops are the children. Like, let me explain to you, like, okay, I know the situation. Yeah, but let me explain to you like a few more facts that you don't seem to know about it. Oh, you don't know about these facts? That's okay. You don't have to learn these today. That's all right, kids. Everybody's learning. Back to the chapter.
Yeah. So that isn't how anybody is acting in this scene.
No, and it's interesting too, because the last time we had a really big sidebar, we actually had a lot of sidebars about power structure and empire. It was like really, really early on in the book, and then it was a lot of character stuff.
Yeah.
And now we're examining these power structures again, and we see the world in a microcosm.
Yeah, and we get to see those power structures most when there's friction inside it. When yeah. somebody is, like, the first big conversation we had about the Empire power structure was around Gideon and Crux disagreeing about whether or not she was a slave.
Mm-hmm.
And here, it's people are disagreeing about what the definitions of the power are, and that disagreement shows us what's happening and what's possible and what's not clear in context.
Yeah, and we have multiple parts of this. We have the second versus the third versus the first. We have the eighth versus the ninth. We have, like, I think those two are the strongest. I think the sixth somehow removing themselves from the larger picture and not having to participate in that dialogue is conspicuously absent.
I will say that that is a really classic academic move.
Sure.
Academics really like to pretend to be above the fray and totally irrelevant to politics and just really not affected by all of that, despite getting all of their money from the government, or like a really large amount of money from the government, and therefore being really heavily influenced by the government and its structures.
Yeah. The fourth in this, like, are I think their powerlessness really speaks to the way that they fit into this power structure. Like they're grieving. They are feeling like they somehow need to reassert the power structure through revenge. Their lack of a direction to put their current feelings while everyone else is like fighting between themselves. They're like, no, there's something bigger and we need to take revenge on it or else nothing is going to be okay.
We only care about the monster.
Yeah.
I think it's worth noticing here as well that this is a highly specialized structure. You know, we've talked about like the third is the propaganda house and the ninth is the weird religious house and the eighth is the normal religious house. Like, okay, cool, whatever. The second is military leadership and the fourth is ground troops. And it's there has always been sort of a distinction between the enlisted man and the officers. But this is a big gap. They're not even adjacent houses. They're not related. They're opposing colors. Like, I mean, red and blue aren't, you know, opposite on the color wheel. But like red and blue are they feel like a bit opposite, you know? There's an incredible distance. Isaac and Jean-Marie talk, I think later, that like they're like, we're not cannon fodder. We're, you know, we're not to be wasted, but we are to be used. And that's a sweet thing to tell yourself when you're a 14-year-old child soldier. But they have big families. They're just a farm.
Yeah. And I think it is easier for Isaac to think of it being a monster than it being someone who is playing with power. Because then all of a sudden it's a person. And that person is one of these people. And the ramifications of that on him and his worldview are quite big.
Yeah, a metaphysical monster is the only thing that kills a good person.
Yeah.
We get some more information here about relationships that we haven't seen before.
Yep.
Silas told Abigail about the facility at the dinner. And Abigail received that information and immediately went down there or something. We don't technically know that Abigail and Magnus went to the facility themselves. It seems likely, but we don't know.
The thing that gives us the most information, in my opinion, to try and answer that question is the sword out of the scabbard. It would be implausible for a sword to fall out of a scabbard while dumping someone down a hole.
Yeah. It's certainly not a well-fitted scabbard, and the quality of Magnus's things does not support that.
And it would be impractical to murder a pair of people and then bring them to a hole, remove one person's sword, drop them down the hole, and then drop the sword.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense.
You know, as you interpreted it before, the most sensible way of interpreting that sword being removed and falling the way it did is if Magnus was actively trying to defend Abigail in the moment of their deaths.
We don't actually know for sure that they got thrown down there.
No, I always kind of imagined it as they got murdered into a hole.
They might have gone all the way down the ladder and been killed in the facility. What we know is that they're mangled.
Yes.
We don't actually know that they were killed at the top or that they died from the fall. What we know is all their shit's broken and they don't have faces anymore.
Yeah.
The not have faces anymore was a thing that I didn't clock until this reread.
Yeah, I don't think I had really fully noticed that either. But what's left of their faces is a big fucking statement.
We don't have a description of expression. We don't have a description of skin tone. We don't have a description of anything like that. Because often, you know, in death, you'll be like, oh, their eyes were closed. Their eyes were open. Their face.
We don't have any.
There was nothing about an expression to be interpreted left on their faces. Of their faces. So knowing that, confirmed this chapter, the ninth locked it before they went in after dinner. Someone had to unlock it. Keys possessed were the eighth, the fifth, the sixth, who were not down there at that time, according to information we get later. The seventh remains ambiguous, but did identify that they could. But it was locked after the ninth went down. So someone had to have intentionally opened it for them to go through, either themselves or the person dumping them down a hole or pushing down a hole or murdering them into a hole. Silas has not tried to take the key from Colum in the ways that Harrow has tried to take it from Gideon.
However, Ionte has a key.
And did not tell anyone else of the third.
The person who has the key ring is allowed to have the key.
Is this the first time someone's broken the rules in public? Like, it outed for breaking the rules since people have got here?
About the keys?
Yeah.
This technically doesn't break the rule. Teacher didn't say that the key ring must belong to the Cav. It is given to the Cav. Nothing is stated about that.
Yeah.
Harrow is concerned that this is a rule, but nobody has actually said that this is a rule. And I think the fact that teacher gives the key to Ionte indicates that it's not a rule.
Yeah. Yep.
The only thing was, when asked for the key, teacher will only surrender it to somebody who says that they have a safe place to keep it. And it is possible, given the role of iron in folklore, that the iron loop is a safe place for the key because the ghosts can't fuck with it.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't have the key off the ring. The ring protects the keys from the ghosts.
So Ianthe had some other way of protecting the key.
No, she stole the key ring from Beth.
Oh, she stole the key ring.
Yeah. And so she was able to show that she had the key ring, and so she could get the key.
And Corona's reaction is really, it is that combination of like utter devastation, yet incredibly high context, high masking, nobility, level of subtlety. And like Corona immediately bails.
She had already said to the group, we had no idea that basement was even there. And then Ianthe is like, I knew, I've been in there a bunch. It totally fucks up their whole situation. And what's interesting is that teacher forces Ianthe to disclose that, which is a level of sort of interventionism that we haven't really seen from teacher. Because Ianthe is not the sort to just sort of cop to that kind of stuff. It was a secret. She wanted to keep it a secret. It was going to mess up her relationships. So as they're talking about, okay, who has a key? Who could have been there? Teacher just starts staring at her aggressively.
And they have put a lot of effort into keeping a certain front to the rest of everyone. And that front largely is for Ianthe's benefit in a lot of ways. But I think at this point she's realized she doesn't need it anymore. Because she can still use Babs's body. He can't really deny her that. But she doesn't need to lie anymore because now she has access to the kind of escalating information that leads to what she wants, which is power. She doesn't need Corona anymore.
She doesn't.
No, she feels this. Like, this is the moment where she's like, yeah, actually, I don't need you.
This is where her and Corona's deal breaks. Because Ianthe, having gotten into the facility, has started to realize, I think she has by now realized that she can solve the puzzles just on a theoretical level and that she doesn't need anyone else at all. She is what Harrow thought she was. And Ianthe is like, oh, I don't actually have to fake shit for Corona anymore because I'm going to be a lictor and then I will fix everything on the back end.
Yeah.
But instead of telling Corona that the plan had changed, she just sort of abandons her.
And essentially, you know, they walk off and it's, you know, it's like obvious they're going to go and have it out. But at the same time, Corona and Babs don't have any power to really reassert themselves in this scenario. Like, Corona is just a person.
Yeah, they're just going to be angry at her.
Yeah. And Babs now has to deal with Ianthe as her cavalier with a lot less of Corona's protection because Corona doesn't have the same kind of, you know, power anymore.
Although Corona's also not going to be Ianthe's enforcer anymore.
Yeah.
So their whole dynamic is broken.
Yeah. And we think about her presence in book three. And, you know, this is probably a turning point in her life.
Totally. Totally. This is probably the first big crack for her between her and the Empire.
Absolutely.
So, as several folks go off to investigate the bodies in the freezer room, we're kind of left with Gideon watching Silas try to get Colm's soul back.
And at first, it comes across in this very like supplicant way, this like praying to a higher power. It's a bit ritual-like, in a way that's almost a little uncharacteristically like subservient. Like he's kneeling, like he's holding his hand gently. It's the visual is so distinctly different from the relationship that we've seen so far.
There's a tenderness, yeah.
And as soon as Colm's soul is back, that tenderness is gone.
I felt like it was before that. I feel like at a distance it looked like there was this tenderness, but as soon as you see teacher ask about it, the answer is gross to me. Teacher's like, "Hey, listen, it's harder to get back into your body here," which seems to be what he's saying. You know, like this
Yeah,
is going to be
absolutely.
harder than he's used to. Because of what Kanan House is like, or because of what the first is like, or because of what the facility is like, he's just gonna have a rougher time getting back in. And teacher is like, is he good at this? Is he gonna be okay? And
Yeah.
Silas is totally dismissive, but the way that he frames it puts all of the agency for this situation on Colm, not on himself. He says he has never once let his body become corrupted and he never shall. So there's this framework of like, if I suck his soul out through a straw and he gets taken over by demons, that's him being impure. That's him
Yeah.
being corrupted. That's not me emptying his soul out of his body. That I did normal, cool stuff. He needs to do cool stuff now. To not be
Yeah.
taken over by demons. And I thought that was such a shitty framework.
Yeah. The purity thing is really what Silas upholds his whole worldview and behavior and fucking personality with. That, like, I am pure, therefore I am inherently better than you, is in every interaction he has. But it's not just that, it's like fundamentally baked in to his sense of self and his sense of his practice as a necromancer. Like, his necromancy is somehow better than everyone else's too. And purity is the theme of that belief.
And teacher, who was built by the gods to do the gods stuff, is horrified by what Silas is doing. This is not God's plan.
Yeah, he's really worried about Colm. He's distressed at what he's seeing. He is using what he knows to try and alleviate what Colm's experiencing and to protect his body and to bring his soul back.
Teacher is emotionally stricken looking at this. He's aghast at it. He is concerned, but it's not the same kind of concern that he has for like the well-being of the fourth in this moment. I think it's this is sacrilegious.
Yeah, which begs the question of like, if this is sacrilege according to, the eyes and voice of God in the room right now, when was this necromancy developed and why was it allowed to continue in this shape and form? And how long has it had been allowed to continue in this shape and form? And how long has that been out in public?
And why doesn't anybody respond to Judith the way they respond to Silas? Because Judith does the same thing. She just does it to enemies.
Yeah. Really sets up an interesting us and them kind of criteria. And I think one of the things that has popped up a lot now in this chapter is the fact that some of the ambiguity between of the answers to these questions that we've asked is part of what is wielded against people. The goalposts in all of these are mobile because that means that more people can be included under the them. More people can be excluded from the us because it is mobile, because it is ambiguous. We can use these rules when it serves us, and we are not going to be clear about what and why we're serving. Because if we're transparent about that information, we don't get to have the power in the same way anymore.
Yeah. I think the level of ambiguity also really encourages infighting in the way that we see it doing in this chapter.
Yeah.
That it destabilizes challenges to John's power and the power of the First, because the First doesn't engage with the infighting. It's like, oh, we're not part of that. You just don't have the power. Like, you just can't challenge me.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not upset that you did that. I'm not mad at you. You're just wrong. But the fact that the houses squabble amongst themselves, that there isn't ambiguity, like there's a sense that they're not equal, but it's not 100% clear who's on top of who, that makes it really hard to do these relationships in a way that is trusting, that is productive.
Yeah. Yeah. The lack of clarity means everyone is constantly suspicious of the others.
Speaking of which, it's really interesting in this chapter that the person who's pushing so, so hard for trust and sharing information and collaboration is Corona, who is fundamentally lying to everyone about who she is. Corona wants so much for everybody to just be able to trust each other.
Yeah, because in a way, she is the closest thing to them in the room. She, as, you know, not a cavalier, not a necro, just a gal, is most at risk of losing access to this power. You know, she feels the vulnerability that, for the first time maybe, in a very real way, that the people who are objectified and you know, alienated and marginalized by this logic, by this like movable, you know, value set and theocracy, like, yeah, this is a turning point for her in, I think, realizing that she's not one of the people who gets to keep this power. She's one of the people who gets to be eaten by it.
Yeah. And she obviously had already been flirting with the cavalier role and secretly wishing that she could be a cavalier instead.
Mm-hmm.
But to a large degree, I think that's so that she could have a job, so that she could have a role, so that she could fit in.
Yeah.
And this is a real confrontation with kind of how nasty it can get for a lot of people. But also, they don't care what happens to Colin. Nobody hangs around to make sure he's okay. They go look at dead people who are still going to be dead 10 minutes from now. They just don't care.
Which, like, we love Palamedes, but shines the same light on Palamedes that we have shone on Magnus and Abigail, in the sense that, like, they are absolutely cogs in this system, and they are absolutely dehumanizing the people in the same way that the rest of the system is, and they don't get to say they're above it. Palamedes said, "Excuse me, I'm sorry," to Abigail's body, but maybe that was not for just reasons just engaging with her humanity, but for reasons that are upheld by the power structure that is, you know, given him his position in life.
And the two people who really care whether Colm turns out okay, our teacher, who is a collection of dead guys stuffed in a human suit, and Gideon, who's a slave. And she sees in Colm the closest to her own situation.
Yeah.
And it's not that she likes him. It's not that she is pals. She just cares about him because he's an alive person.
And, you know, it highlights some of the inherent tragedy of this book, in the sense that, like, Gideon's empathy and disgust at the overall system lessens over the course of the narrative.
It does.
And that's heartbreaking.
As she becomes more powerful, she cares less. Nunpod with Left Grief is created by Claire Beans and Han Cayley, and edited by Han Cayley. Our music is Only Human by Philip Ayers. Visit us at nunpod.com. That's NUNPOD.com. Thanks for listening.